welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday, 30th of October, with me, Ian Welsh. During Innovation Forum's Future of Plastics event last week, I caught up with Coca-Cola European Partners Vice President for Sustainability, Joe Francis. We talked about how to set stretching recycling targets, the barriers to achieving them, and the pros and cons of deposit return schemes. And as a preview for next week's Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities Conference, coming up is a chance to hear again a series of short interviews with speakers and panellists recorded at last year's event. That's all coming up shortly. No news roundup this week, that'll return next time. All of us at Innovation Forum are looking forward to our Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities Conference next week. We have an extended conference over 3 days from 3rd to 5th November, and among the 300 plus taking part are senior representatives from Sime Darby, April, Cargill, Unilever, Tate and Lyle, WWF, Burger King and the Consumer Goods Forum. All details are on innovationforum.co.uk, and it's not too late to join us. And I look forward to speaking with many of you at the conference networking sessions during the event. We're also continuing with the work of our Action Research project into smallholder farmers and developing some new research for the apparel sector. Do get in touch if this is of interest. A few days ago, during Innovation Forum's Future of Plastics event, I spoke with Joe Francis, Vice President for Sustainability at Coca-Cola European Partners. Among other things, we discussed the challenges around meeting stretching targets and what's necessary to shift the needle on recycling rates. We've just been on a conference session at the Innovation Forum's Future of Plastics event, so let's pick up some of the things that came out of that session. Why don't you start off, Joe, by outlining the targets that you've set as a business around plastics, why you've set them, and the barriers to achieving them.
Let me first of all just say a little bit about the global Coca-Cola World Without Waste strategy, which is very much looking at a 2030 horizon, focused very much on all of the things that I'll talk about in Western Europe. There is a bit of a distinction, certainly at the global level, looking at a 2030 horizon, and the targets that I'll talk about within Europe, we're probably a bit ahead of that. So our most ambitious target, which is around ensuring that 100% of the packaging that we put onto the market, or putting it another way, collecting a bottle or a can for everyone we sell, that all of that material comes back. That's that 100% collection goal. We're aiming to get to that by 2025. So that's probably 5 years ahead of the global target. We think that today we're somewhere at around about 75, 77% of our packaging coming back. And we're very fortunate in our business that about 85% of what we put onto the market is bottles and cans, either refillable bottles or plastic bottles or glass bottles, all of which fully and entirely recyclable. About another 10% is dispensed, so no packaging at all. So the vast majority of what we put onto the market is recyclable. It can come back, can be collected. The challenge is probably one of infrastructure, which in many markets doesn't quite exist in the same way as markets that have, for example, deposit return schemes. That's our first big target. Our second big target is around ensuring that by 2023, so 3 years out, we can be in a place where half of all of the plastic we use is recycled plastic. Ultimately, looking further ahead, aiming to eliminate the use of virgin oil-based PET entirely. And one of the things I said earlier at the event was that if we were successful at doing that, it would enable us to remove somewhere in the region of 200,000 tons of virgin oil-based PET. And that kind of gives you a glimpse of the size and the scale of the challenge. Today, about a third of the plastic we use is recycled PET. So we're using somewhere in the region of 60,000 to 70,000 tons today. We're on track for 50%, but it's not a linear path. So in some markets, for example, Norway or Sweden and the Netherlands, we're either already at or will very soon be at 100%. Other markets like GB, where the infrastructure for getting that material back is a little trickier, we're somewhere in the region of 50%. And then we've also got a number of our brands that have already moved to 100% recycled PET. And so those two goals, 100% collection and 50% recycled PET, they work interdependently. The biggest barrier, you asked me about the challenges, the biggest barrier, certainly when you think about recycled PET, is a barrier really around feedstock. It's about feedstock quality. It's about the fact that the demand now exceeds supply. And it's a fact that in many of our markets, we just don't see the type of quality coming back through collection schemes that we really need to satisfy our demand. There's another challenge in which I thought I'd make, which is one of technology. Certainly, we've been relying for many years on traditional mechanical recyclings, where you collect material, you flake it, you shred it, you clean it, and then you reform it into new plastic that can be used again for plastic bottles. We are going to need to see a significant scale up of new technologies like enhanced recycling that allows us to take hard to recycle plastics and then turn that plastic into food grade recycled PET. And we've done a few things recently. We've invested in something called Cure, which is technology that's been created by the Morsenkopf Group, which again gives a new lease of life for difficult to recycle plastic waste. The Coca-Cola company's been working with Ionica to help them reach a scale up for a new closed loop recycling technology. And so that technology challenge, I think, is going to be really key. You asked me also why we're setting the targets, and I wanted just to very briefly touch on that. First of all, really important, we really do understand the size and the scale of the problem around plastic pollution. And at the same time, recognize that we've got a responsibility to help fix that. We're also looking very firmly at the challenge around circularity, circular economy, which we discussed quite a lot at the conference, where we're absolutely convinced that we've got to get to a place where all of our packaging is collected. It doesn't end up as litter, waste, oceans, and that material can be used. But we're also thinking about climate, Ian. Because when we look at our value chain carbon footprint, 40% is related to our packaging. And we will not be able to transition to become a low carbon business unless we reduce the carbon footprint of our packaging.
Let's think a bit back to feedstock. Price issues must be a major challenge for you. I mean, right now, the price of virgin oil-based feedstock is low. It's very low, particularly compared to when using recycled feedstock. So how do you deal with the internal arguments around, well, look, economically, it makes more sense to go back to virgin oil-based feedstock rather than using recycled content?
You're absolutely right. And recycled PET is at a significant premium at the moment. We've seen virgin PET prices certainly fall. I mean, actually, there used to be a correlation between recycled PET and virgin PET pricing. And actually, we see them now mainly moving almost independently of each other. If your strategy is based on a strategy around circularity, you've got to put your money where your mouth is. For us, when we're thinking about a world without waste, or we're thinking about collecting 100% of our packaging, you can't just invest in the collection piece. You've got to then invest in what happens to that material. And so in that sense, using the euros or the pounds that we've got to make sure that we're investing in recycled PET to bring it back, to put it back into our bottles, is demonstrating that we can truly get close to a circular economy. If you think about markets like Norway or Sweden or Germany that really do have, certainly in the Nordics, well-designed, well-functioning deposit return schemes, they are truly circular. But they're only truly circular if you're then using that material and putting it back into the marketplace. That's why we've chosen in Norway and Sweden, we've chosen those markets to be the first markets where we move to a place where every single one of our plastic bottles will be 100% recycled PET. So you've got that true circularity. And that's why we're investing. Yes, it does cost us money. And yes, we believe it's the right thing to do. But again, over time, we do believe that that differential will come down. Because over time, if we are successful in getting to a place where deposit return schemes are in place across all of our markets, we will have much greater volume of high quality feedstock. And that's why we think of deposit return schemes as not just kind of a once in a lifetime opportunity to transform this, but they actually then deliver a future fit supply chain for food grade recycled PET that can be used again and again in our bottles. And that's why we're so involved in those discussions.
Coca-Cola has certainly thoroughly and firmly nailed its colours to the mast in terms of deposit return schemes. Now, I mean, I know there was some ambiguity in the past. There are, of course, a number of challenges. The principal one is raised is that if you take an example of the market like the UK, we have quite a relatively successful domestic curbside recycling now. And if you remove PET from that, a PET being typically one of the most valuable recyclates, then the economic viability of that curbside recycling diminishes. What's the best way to get around that?
We've seen many markets globally where deposit return schemes for beverage packaging coexist and sit alongside curbside or at-home recycling systems and schemes for other materials. So we truly believe that's the way forward. And look, the reality is, it referred to some ambiguity. In years gone by, maybe we didn't support deposit return schemes in the way we do now, and that's been the case. In years gone by, we were also putting our weight behind existing curbside schemes, EPR schemes. But the reality is that many of those schemes have stalled. Many of those schemes either do not work for beverage packaging. And in many markets, you know, I live and work in London, and although I'm out and about in the centre of London as much as I would like in the last few months, you continue to see plastic bottles littering the street. And it's very similar if you go into central Paris or some cities in Spain. And the reality is that curbside or at-home recycling is not delivering the same collection rates for beverage packaging that deposit return schemes deliver. And that's why we've thrown our weight behind deposit return schemes. Look, we've got very clear direction in Europe from the EU Single Plastic Directive. You have a very clear 90% collection target by 2029, 77% by 2025. We're hoping that we're going to be ahead of that with our 100% collection by 2025. We wanted to set that as the North Star. We've got a very strong roadmap. But look, it's tough, right? There are challenges around infrastructure. Politics is also slow. Whilst there was a raging discussion about the size and the shape of the deposit return scheme in Scotland, look, frankly, our political leaders have had a lot more important things to think about in the last 12 months than deposit return schemes. But at the same time, Scottish Government has signalled its intention to have that in place by the summer of 2022. So the discussions continue. But the nature of setting these schemes up is inherently slow. It's not the kind of thing we can do alone. A deposit return scheme for Coca-Cola packaging would not work. It's not the kind of thing. It's got to be national. It's got to be comprehensive. It's got to be simple to use for the consumer and simple to understand.
I guess what it's doing is it is applying a sort of value, a hint of our sense of value into the plastic bottle that wasn't there before. And that, if you like, is almost a market-based solution to a problem that's, as you say, to get to the sort of levels of recycling that are necessary and that you and similar companies have committed to. Let's think about use of a different feedstock. We've had a session already at the conference around bioplastic materials. So is that part of your future use of virgin bioplastic materials rather than oil-based materials?
When you talk about bioplastics, I find it such a strange term, because when people talk about bioplastics, they can mean one of two very different things. You can either mean plastics that come from biomaterials, and the Coca-Cola company was the very first company to kind of get into this market, pioneering plant bottle, bringing plant-based material that is fully recyclable and putting it into plastic. And you can recycle a plant bottle in exactly the same way you can recycle a normal PET bottle or a PET bottle made from recycled content. And many of our bottles today have both PET from plant-based sources as well as PET from recycled PET. But you can also, by the term bioplastic, mean biodegradable plastic. So that's why I find the term very confusing. On the biodegradable piece, in terms of biodegradability, in terms of plastic for beverage bottles, that's something we're not a fan of. We're not going to pursue that strategy. We're not going to pursue that strategy because we think it confuses the consumer. We think it also would contaminate the recycling stream. So if you put biodegradable material next to material that is recycled content, then it's going to completely confuse and contaminate the whole system. So we're not supporting biodegradable material for plastic bottles, but certainly bio-based material we'd be great fans of. But at the moment, let's be very clear, at the moment we're really focused on the circularity piece. I think we see a future where, going back to our goal, if we are to avoid this 200,000 tons of virgin all-based plastic, which is, and by the way, that's a kind of a figure for Western Europe, if we are to do that, then we see the future being recycled PET that comes through mechanical recycling, recycled PET that comes through chemical recycling, and then probably a portion of PET that comes through bioplastics, for example, plant bottle material. We see the world in the future as being, the world of plastic being probably those three sources, eliminating virgin all-based PET. That would be the aim.
Something that came up a lot in our session and was really a focus of the audience attending the session was the collaboration. I mean, the fact that we had representative of Coca-Cola and a representative of PepsiCo on the same session was great. And it indicates that there is a degree of recognition of the necessary collaboration. So how do you categorize the sense of collaboration you're feeling within the industry? I mean, you sense you really can't solve all these problems on your own.
When you look at the size and the scale of the climate crisis that we're facing, or you look at the size and the scale of the challenge around plastic pollution, it's not something that Coca-Cola is going to be able to solve just by acting alone. So things like the Ellen MacArthur Foundation commitments, the plastic packs that we're seeing, even when you look at deposit return schemes, it's going to require big brands to work together, but also to work together with retailers. If you look at chemical recycling, it's going to require companies to come together to help scale up new solutions. If you look at alternatives to plastic, probably the best, one of the things that we're most excited about is the new TerraCycle Loop shopping platform. We've seen it with Carrefour in France. Now we've got it with Tesco in Great Britain. Again, that's a great example of collaboration because it brings many different brands together on one platform that gives an alternative that's far more circular for the consumer. So we're really optimistic around the collaboration piece because these discussions are far, far bigger than even a company the size and the scale of Coca-Cola. So we're ready to collaborate, and that has to happen if we're going to solve the challenges.
The TerraCycle Loop project, of course, is consumers bringing their own packaging to the store and taking the product away and then bringing back their own packaging, or indeed having reusable packaging for the products.
It's very much about reusable packaging. It's not necessarily the consumer bringing their own pack. I mean, for example, in the TerraCycle Loop model, the consumer can go and purchase a 1 litre bottle of Coca-Cola or a 1 litre bottle of Coca-Cola Zero. But that bottle is a refillable glass bottle. They'll take it home, they'll enjoy it, they'll leave it in their Loop tote bag, it'll be collected, then it'll come back, it'll be washed and it'll be refilled, and then it'll go back out. In some markets, that's very, very familiar to people. But actually in a market like Great Britain, we've not had refillable glass in GB for maybe 20, 30 years. It's a little bit back to the future, but it's also very new. It looks great. In fact, we found out recently that Coca-Cola Zero is actually one of the highest selling SKUs in the Tesco Loop model. So we're quite proud of that. So consumers are really excited about it and it's working well.
I remember well myself returning glass bottles for pocket money when I was a kid in Scotland. So it is a bit of, as you say, back to the future in some respects. Obviously, we have been talking about the kind of necessary drivers of getting your targets met by 2025 and 2030 and other deadlines. How important is the impact of consumers and also activists providing necessary pressure to keep you moving forward? Because as you say, the solutions aren't all there yet. So is it just the consumer pressure and activist pressure? Is that a help for you to drive forward and meet your targets?
I think it's always a help. I think from an activist perspective, we work with many NGOs. We have dialogue with many NGOs and activists, and we really welcome that. They do a phenomenal job at highlighting the size and the scale of the challenge. They do a phenomenal job at really pushing the business community, and we welcome that and we continue that dialogue. I think from a consumer perspective, I think there are some challenges. You know, one of the challenges we see is that sometimes the consumer preferred pack may not always be the most sustainable pack. It may not always be the pack with the lowest carbon footprint. I mean, if you ask consumers, consumers have a very strong preference for glass, but actually a one-way glass bottle probably has the highest carbon footprint of all packs. Many consumers look at a plastic bottle and say, okay, maybe in a certain channel, I don't want that today. But the reality is that if that pack has high percentage of recycled content in it and does come back through a deposit return scheme, it actually delivers a very, very low carbon footprint when compared with many other pack types. And I think that, look, consumers just want to do the right thing. And that's absolutely right. We're all consumers. I also want to do the right thing when I'm buying a soft drink or any other product. So I expect companies that are providing products to be doing the right thing on my behalf. And that's exactly why we're thinking about things like recycled content in pack. We're putting it in, we're putting a message on pack to say that the pack's not just recyclable, but now that pack contains recycled content. Look, I think it will also take some time for consumers to understand the differences. 100% recyclability, 100% recycled content, 100% recycling, they all mean slightly different things. And it's no surprise that the consumer gets a little bit confused. We also know very clearly that they want companies like Coke to make the right choices on their behalf. And that's exactly why we are proactively investing in things like recycled PET and putting it back into our bottles.
I think you're right. It's all about the changing relationship between consumers and the brands that they trust. The whole plastic pollution debate took off was, again, a lot of it came back to the fact that consumers were seeing plastic pollution all around them. And that really was the driver for them, was this shouldn't be happening. And I guess that then is setting the challenge for brands like Coca-Cola to really try and meet that. And then, of course, Coca-Cola has to then take consumers with them, because if you want us to do that, here's what that means. So it's sort of interesting the way that the relationship between consumers and their brands is changing. Joe, as always, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thanks very much for joining me once again on the Innovation Forum podcast.
Pleasure. Thanks, Ian.
At last year's Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities Conference, Tom Idle and I did a series of very quick interviews with some of the leading expert panellists immediately after their panel sessions. Now, as a preview for next week's Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities Conference, here is a chance to hear from them again. Stay tuned to hear from Justin Adams, Executive Director of Tropical Forest Alliance, Lawrence Ruffaut, Director Operations and Sustainability at Philip Morris International, Nick Sheen, Chief Technology Officer with Authenticate, Helen Browning, Chief Executive of the Soil Association, Michael Gidney, CEO of the Fair Trade Association, Francis Way, Chief Strategy Officer at CDP, Stephen Donofrio, Director, Forest Trends Supply Chain Initiative, Jonathan Horrell, Director of Sustainability with Mondelez International, and Peter Stanbury Davis, Principal at the Frontier Practice. I'm with Justin Adams from the Tropical Forest Alliance, and we've just come out of a session where we've been discussing developing the landscape approach for corporates. So, Justin, at the very start of the session, we had a word cloud, and the winners in the word cloud were investment, transparency, and incentives. How do you feel that they were reflected in the discussions?
They're a good reflection. What we covered is just the critical importance of landscape approaches to bring collective action, which requires collaboration. So that was probably the word that I would have hoped to see more of in the word cloud. Because without collaboration, we're not going to get all of the stakeholders sitting around the table and actually finding solutions that work for producers, work for producer governments, the local governments, as well as then the market actors who are demanding improved environmental and social conditions. So I think that's the why of this is there. I think we also kind of then started moving into, so what role can companies play? And companies, of course, can play a role about investment, bringing investment into a landscape, complementing what they're doing with their existing supply chain approaches. But also, how do companies bring their buying dollars? That's where they're going to put most. That's how they can often have most of the impact. So how do we actually bring sourcing, preferential sourcing into a landscape? And then lastly, the one we often underestimate is the role of advocacy and the voice that companies can bring to actually support some of the transitions and the long-term vision of these things. Investment, certainly, incentives are a part of that, of how we're going to get this to the producer. The piece, though, that I think we also spent time on that troubles me is this notion of how we're going to measure progress, because companies like to be able to measure. The whole model that we have today is that companies measure progress on a quarterly or an annual basis. So certification, it's relatively easy to measure progress. With a landscape approach, these are long-term, complex, collaborative initiatives, and how you measure that is really challenging. And I think that's key that we as a whole community work to bring that in, but also how companies think about accommodating KPIs, measurement that supports collective action versus just their own individual action. That's much, much easier for them to measure.
We had a question about the urgency of the climate crisis and the mass extinction crisis that we're seeing. But at the same time, we're talking about landscapes approach to take a long time and they're long term. So I guess the important thing is to have measurable milestones along the way.
Correct.
That allow determining of success as we go.
Yes. For me, the criticality of the urgency of action, but also the complexity of what's needed, particularly down at the landscape level, is that we've got to get better at managing duality, right? The polarity that exists today, that we've got to both go fast, but we've also got to go together, is absolute, and it's paramount that we address that. So there are things that we can move forward with quickly, where we know we can make progress, where there's agreement, where there's simple actions that make sense. Some of the issues are going to require more dialogue, more discussion, understanding the trade-offs, and that's where we need more patience, and we need to be able to recognize if we hurry everything, we'll end up alienating producers and creating the toxic debate that we see in some of the countries today that feel this is all being done to them rather than with them.
So we have Laurence from Philip Morris here. We've just finished a really interesting session on the future viability of the smallholder model in driving sustainability in commodity production. Laurence, what was your one key takeaway from that session? Is the smallholder model sustainable?
Yes, it is. Now, there are certain elements that need to be considered when we talked about smallholder farmers. It's obviously the acreage of land that smallholder farmers own or can work on. That's the first element. But I think what is crucial if we want to have a sustainable smallholder farmers is that these farmers actually manage to make living income and a living income for the household. So to do this, we need to ensure that the crop is being grown in an efficient way so that the productivity is good, if we're talking about a specific crop. But in addition, that we support smallholder farmers to diversify so that they have more than one source of income. And by having multiple sources of income through diversification, we should be able to support them to achieve a living income for their household. And that's how I would see the smallholder business, let's say, sustainable for the future.
Joining me is Nick Sheen, Chief Technology Officer at Authenticate, and we're just come out of a session where we've been talking about blockchain and other similar innovations in technology that enable traceability in supply chains. So Nick, why don't you just give us an example of a blockchain in practice and the challenges around it?
So last year we worked on a project with one of our customers who was keen to test blockchain both as a technology and what implementation challenges there might be when we put it into the real world. So we chose the Parma Ham supply chain as our test project. And the main thing for that supply chain is being able to prove the provenance so that you can genuinely claim it's Parma Ham. As a technology, the technology worked really well. It allowed us to use smart contracts to record the properties of each of those suppliers and validate the properties of those suppliers. So you could only breed pigs if you were qualified to breed pigs. You could only slaughter pigs if you had the appropriate qualifications. And the blockchain recorded all that information about the suppliers. We then used the blockchain to record transactions, which were really the movement of pigs through the supply chain. So we could track the pigs when they were born, when they were reared, when they were finished. And then when we got to the abattoir, we realised a very obvious problem, but we didn't realise that it hit us in the face, which was that at one end of the processing, you put a load of pigs in, and at the other end, you get packets of ham out. A packet of ham does not contain the ham from one pig. So your ability to trace is limited by your manufacturing process and the nature of the product. I think for any project looking at traceability back to the farm, we hear a lot of these phrases like farm to fork or sea to shelf or whatever it might be. And where you've got what's grown and what's sold or what's raised and what's sold being the same thing, that is practical. A whole lettuce goes from the field to the fork and can be traced. The chicken goes from where it's raised to the shelf. Where you've got any deconstructed and reconstructed item, you've obviously got limits.
I thought it was great in the session. You said there were four things to typify blockchain for you. Can you just run through them very quickly?
Yeah, sure. So blockchain is a distributed technology, which means that everybody has a copy of it. That means that you don't need a central authority. Nobody needs to run it per se. Everybody runs their own copy. It's transparent in that everybody can see the data that's in the blockchain. You can put security on top if you want to. It has this nice idea of consensus, so everybody has to agree that a transaction can happen. That's usually encapsulated in code, so you haven't got people there pressing buttons, but this idea is consensus, and it is secure by the nature of the encryption and the chaining that's done in the technology.
I've just been talking with Michael Gidney, CEO of the Fair Trade Foundation, and Helen Browning, Chief Executive of the Soil Association, about unlocking the potential of smallholder farmers. Michael, how do we unlock that potential?
Oh, well, so much to do. But the most important thing is to see smallholders as the immense opportunity they are. Too often in the past, smallholders maybe have been perceived as being a problem in global supply chains. They are an opportunity to tell a new story to consumers, to engage in innovation and entrepreneurship at the ground, and also to help all of us protect the climate and to protect the environment.
And what are you doing at the Fair Trade Foundation to develop that potential?
The vast majority of the 1.6 million producers we work with around the world are themselves smallholder farmers. They co-own the global fair trade system, so they are at the heart of our standards, our strategy, our approach, and they're pushing us to innovate in a whole load of different ways, focusing on living incomes, focusing on adaptation and mitigation around the shifting climate and the climate crisis, and engaging consumers who are interested more than ever in provenance and storytelling from the communities where the food that they buy every day is grown.
Helen, for you at the Soil Association, a lot of the issues that are coming up the agenda are the sorts of things that the Soil Association have been talking about for some time. How do you see the Soil Association's issues, if you like, being relevant now for unleashing the potential of smallholder farmers?
Well, I think in a way, in a European context, everybody's scaled up so far now that we've almost got to start to reverse that scale. And I think while you're doing that, you need to think about how can we help ensure that small scale is an advantage, not a disadvantage. And that can be around cooperation and getting people to work together better. It can be about adding more value, finding other income streams, as well as the food and the produce that they're generating. And it can be about just providing some of that core resource, which if you're small, you can't quite afford to have, whether that's good financial advice or the right kind of kit, which you might only need one day every 6 months. So I think it's about really changing the dial on how we see the opportunities for small scale and releasing some of their entrepreneurial spirit that actually can really help small businesses be some of the most innovative out there.
And there are so many things that smallholders can do that at plantation level, our petition size producers will struggle with.
I'm here with Francis Way from CDP. Francis, you've just been moderating a session on how finance can drive the sustainability revolution that we all need. One of the key questions the session aimed to answer is whether sustainability has finally taken centre stage within financial institutions. What's your view based on what you heard in the room and some of the questions we had?
We're seeing that the policies are organisational wide. They're broad thinking, they're covering different assets, and they're really seeing this as quite a complex problem. They're not trying to do a quick fix. So it made me pretty optimistic that sustainability is pretty central because they're really grappling with the real issues and trying to work out how to integrate that into their general practices. And as they said, a more sustainable company is obviously a better client in the long term.
And it's clear that banks have been looking at risk for a long time, but they seem to be moving towards a longer term view of risk. ESG becoming CESG with a big focus on carbon now. How did you sort of read that?
They're looking long term. They're also not just looking at what to screen out. They're looking at how to move to the more sort of sustainable finance system we need and what their role is within that. I think that longer term view of actually trying to think about how you make that transition enabled to ensure that from small companies to larger companies, practices are more sustainable, they're being held to account, but also financed in a way that allows the companies themselves to shift in their practices.
Sure. And the banks we heard from on stage are working hard to develop more solutions. What was the one that really sort of stood out for you?
Oh, because there are quite a lot there. You know, there are obviously the green bonds. I like the sustainability linked loans at the moment because I think that really encourages a change. I'd hope in the future, I suppose, that all loans had sustainability criteria in them anyway, as a sort of general rule. I thought it was interesting, the blended finance conversation, because ultimately some of these more transformational sort of issues, particularly around landscapes, will require that blend of public, private, and potentially philanthropic money as well.
So I'm here with Stephen D'Onofrio from Forest Trends Supply Chain Initiative. Really interesting session, Stephen, on how to tackle deforestation through communities, through smallholders. We heard a lot about RSPO's independent smallholder standard. We heard from L'Oreal about how it's engaging smallholders, the importance of having a physical connection to those smallholders on the ground. So lots of really interesting things that came out of that session. What were the sort of one or two things that you will take away from the session?
I agree completely. Really interesting session. Some of the most illuminating components of this is that we can't get the job done without engaging with smallholders and communities. And the only way to do that is by having an effective toolkit or system and methodology that can get us there.
And based on what you heard in the room and some of the questions that were coming from the audience, do you leave this session more hopeful for the future of smallholders?
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are incredible in terms of how many smallholders out there we depend on. It's really critical to get these folks involved and through the process of certification. So when you have big companies, even though they may not be huge off-takers of the palm or palm kernel oil or whatever the derivative might be, When you see them actively engaging with their smallholders, there's promise in that, where they see that this is really about building a relationship that's long-term, that is further than just mass industrial productivity of land, but it's about supporting livelihoods and social challenges that we all deal with when we're thinking about deforestation. That's what is at the core of dealing with smallholder engagement. It's to tackle those issues and therefore tackle deforestation at the same time.
So I'm joined here by Jonathan Horrell, who's Director of Sustainability at Mondelez. Great session earlier, Jonathan, in which we looked at all things Cocoa and Forests Initiative. For those that missed the session, can you give us a brief overview of what the CFI is?
So Mondelez International, we're a chocolate company, among other things, but we're very big in chocolate. And that means, of course, for us, cocoa is a critical raw material. It's a raw material that faces many challenges. You know, many of its social challenges are very well known and well documented and often talked about. Probably what came later to the story about cocoa is the fact that there is a severe risk now caused not just to the forests in some of the cocoa producing countries, but because of the damage done to forests, also to the sustainability of the cocoa sector itself. We started talking about this publicly in 2015, driven by the scale that we saw of the contribution to our forest footprint and our carbon footprint from deforestation linked to cocoa origins. At around the time, a group of cocoa and chocolate companies, and critically governments of the two major cocoa producing countries, Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire, came together with the right convening with stakeholder partners and international institutions like World Cocoa Foundation and IDH to form this thing called the Cocoa and Forest Initiative. The objective is very simple, which is to reverse the tide, to protect the forest that remains, much of which has been encroached by cocoa farming, typically poor people looking to create an income, and if you like, living on the margins, and to reverse that trend, to protect the forests that remain and to restore forests that have been damaged, and essentially to make cocoa sustainable again so that, you know, the cocoa farmers continue to get their rain that they need to produce their cocoa and that we can all enjoy chocolate.
Sure. So it's been a couple of years since the initiative was launched, and how are things going, how things progressed, and what have we really learned from the initiative?
Well, 2.5 years since the initiative was launched isn't actually very long for something that's complicated. The ambition is very high and the challenges are very great and they're very complex. The progress has been, I would say, steady and at times difficult and also impressive in the sense that we have met the main commitments of the collaboration. So beginning with a statement of intent, following it up with a more detailed framework of action, following it up with all parties producing quite detailed action plans about the things that we're actually going to do. So that includes all the private sector actors, which essentially is every company of any significance involved in cocoa trade or chocolate manufacture in the world, together with the partner governments coming forward with real work. Some of that takes time. Some of that is linked to policy. Some of that is linked to quite difficult and complex questions. But we have seen the initiative moving forward. And of course, as companies, we're implementing real change on the ground. So many of the things that we will implement through Cocoa and Forest Initiative and scale up, like farmer training, like mapping of our farms so that we can monitor that to see whether they're encroaching into forest, all those questions. They were happening anyway through our programs. We have a program, Cocoa Life. And what we're doing through the Cocoa and Forest Initiative is to scale that up, work more with partners, work more consistently between the different actors. So hopefully we can help transform, you know, the cocoa sector in its entirety. One of the most important things about this initiative is that it's the private and public sectors working together with the non-profit sector and international institutions all at the table together. So you have consensus, and consensus sometimes takes time. Mm-hmm. But also critically, if you're looking to protect forests, it's about land use. And land use is something which is governed by governments. And if you want to have good land use planning and proper enforcement, then you simply have to have that right level of collaboration with governments so that the hard choices can be made, if you like, and real progress can be made on the ground. So that, to me, still is the thing that makes this stand out, makes it feel like it's a, if you like, a unique vision of hope in a world that still faces many challenges for forests.
I'm reflecting on Innovation Forum's Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities Forum with Dr. Peter Stanbury-Davis. Welcome to the podcast, Peter.
Hello, Ian. Lovely to speak to you again.
We were in the Landscape Approach workshop at the event in London, a new venture for Innovation Forum, and we were trying to unpick over a couple of hours practical insights into how companies and organizations can implement landscapes approaches within supply chains. What were your main takeaways?
As I think I said on the day, I think one of the really interesting things is having an audience where everyone has a valid point of view, some very, very strong inputs from a wide range of people. It was an extremely interesting session. We had probably about 40 people in the room, all of whom put forward some very interesting points. But I think what was perhaps most interesting was, given that diversity of experience and expertise, quite a lot of common issues came up, quite a lot of issues came up being very similar. And some of these are very, very positive. First of all, one of the issues that was raised was, is a landscapes approach a sort of different way of doing corporate PR? And there's a very, very strong sense that absolutely no, it's not. That actually, if companies are going to engage in this sort of approach, they're going to do so because long-term has a business benefit. And one of the issues that came out very strongly from a number of the groups was that one reason to look at the landscapes approach is simply that, quite simply, the sustainability of supply in the most basic sense, as in, will we still be able to buy soy, coffee, cocoa from some of these countries in 5, 10, 20 years' time? And the idea that businesses are seeing that longevity as having massive business value is incredibly important. I think also important was the sense that other stakeholder groups had to gain from the process. And that even if you had stakeholder groups that were problematic or difficult, you couldn't just ignore them because they were different. That they have a voice and that voice needs to be heard. And there was a lot of talk about how to make sure that the power dynamics between different stakeholders were managed so that even relatively less powerful stakeholders had a voice. So the idea that the equation needs to provide tangible benefits to all parties, I think, again, was incredibly optimistic. It was also interesting to see an evolution in terms of the focus on measurement. Even a couple of the people in the room who came from measurement-based organizations were saying, well, fine, absolutely, standards and so on have made their mark by being able to say they're measurable. But actually, maybe we need to move on from that. Maybe we do have to look at things that are more fluid, where a numeric-based approach isn't perhaps so applicable. So all those were really, really positive issues. The challenges, of course, again, these were points that came out across a number of commentary. First of all, it's bloody complex. You are dealing with a whole mess of social, political, environmental issues, and that is incredibly complicated and difficult to do. Secondly, there's still a reticence, despite the realization that this needs to happen, a reticence to engage with issues like corruption and government capacity, the sense that these can be pretty important factors within a landscapes approach, but a wariness about how to address those properly. And I suppose the big one was really how to start. Everyone was around the room in that two-hour session was effectively saying, yep, this is something that needs to be done. We need to move in this direction. But how do we start? We need to find ways forward, find ways of getting started. I think where we ended up was, rather than try and plan and try and get every possible person one might need or group on board at the beginning, you get together a coalition of those organizations and individuals and stakeholders who are prepared to move forward, and you start there. You try things. If you fail, you fail. You learn from that failure and you move forward. And this sort of much more of an iterative approach, much more exploratory, was very much of the closing message that came out of that session. So we've got a long way to go, but I think the fact there's a real sense of what needs to happen, that it needs to happen, and some ideas of the way forward, I think is an incredibly positive outcome from not just that session, but the whole event.
And as ever, there's plenty more insight and analysis available on innovationforum.co.uk, including the usual audio interviews and podcasts. Look out this week for a Q&A with the Rainforest Alliance's Nigel Sizer on the latest developments with the Landscale Initiative. But that's all for now. I've been Ian Welsh. I'll be back next week reporting from the Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities Conference.